Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, celebrating over 70 years of service to financial advisors, their clients, and institutions worldwide. Putnam Investments, a world of investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
Never a dull moment with the Greek debt crisis, huh? One person, one vote, and a whole lot of economic mayhem. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Novo Nordisk, for nearly 90 years committed to innovation in diabetes care. Learn more at novonordisk-us.com. And by Ally Bank, offering Pop Money, a way to pay other people online by sending an email or text. Learn more at allybank.com.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It's Tuesday, today the 1st of November. Good to have you with us. And on the face of it, what Greek Prime Minister George Papandreou did yesterday makes sense. Offering the people a chance to vote in a country that basically invented the chance to vote. You wouldn't normally expect financial market pandemonium to follow, but these aren't normal times. Investors and entire economies are fragile. So when Papandreou said he'd hold a referendum on the latest Eurozone bailout, what followed was sadly predictable. Stock markets tanked, currencies gyrated, and speculation mounted that the rescue package hammered out just last week is already unraveling. From the European desk in London, Stephen Beard gets us going.
No one was expecting it, not even his cabinet colleagues. Last night, Prime Minister Papandreou stunned Greece and the rest of Europe by offering his voters a say on the latest bailout package. Blanka Kolenikova of IHS Global Insight.
It seems as if it is kind of like an act of desperation to receive wider and better public mandate for pushing through further austerity in the future.
The move was undeniably democratic, but also risky. If the Greeks reject the bailout package, the country will almost certainly default and then possibly crash out of the Eurozone. Most Greeks want to stick with the euro, but commentator John Serapalis says the people are so fed up with austerity they could all too easily vote no in a referendum.
People are very disoriented and they're suffering from the economic austerity measures and the collapse of the Greek economy into recession for a third year running. There's no way of knowing what will happen.
Even before the referendum, Papandreou's move has already backfired, says Greek journalist Martina Stevis.
What Papandreou thought is a good move for him internally, politically, in Greece, is turning into the market's biggest nightmare.
And Greece's biggest European partners, Germany and France, are turning their guns on the Greek leader. At this week's G20 summit, Papandreou will come under intense pressure to reconsider his referendum. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
As always, the straight news of the day is nothing if not put into the proper context. So for that, we've called Jacob Kierkegaard. He's a research fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Jacob, good to have you with us.
My pleasure.
One assumes Mr. Papandreou is an astute observer of the political condition, and he knew that what has been happening today would be happening. So why'd he do it?
Well, I think he basically reacts to this sort of increasingly obvious reality, which is that the strategy that he and the Greek government have been using to implement the IMF program in the last couple of years is essentially crumbling. He no longer commands the loyalty of his own party, and therefore he basically needs to engineer a solution that is spreading the political pain, so to speak, of these reforms across other political parties in Greece.
You have to believe, though, that the European Union is now looking at this and saying, you know what, we're just going to take our toys and go home. We're not going to keep this offer on the table. And so he's betting, really, Papandreou is, that the EU wants more to save the EU than it is angry at him, if that makes any sense.
Yes and no. I mean, I think there's no doubt that the Europeans are going to respond angrily to this, as they already have, and they're basically going to tell the Greeks, look, it's take it or leave it. Yeah. You're either in or you're out, and beggars can't be choosers. So now get on with the program. I mean, this is what I think we're going to see at this dinner that they're going to have in Cannes right before the G20 meeting.
Yeah. What I wouldn't give to be a fly on that wall, right?
Almost certainly, yeah. Because it really is critical that they get the timetable for last week's deal back on track.
Here's the thing, though. There are so few instances where anything in this entire episode has been unambiguously clear. Why do you think now they're going to start?
This is a hugely risky gamble. The last thing that the euro area wants is for, the populations in other countries, in Portugal and Ireland, also saying, look, we want to have a referendum every 3 months about implementing our IMF program. So, no, this is the introduction of a new, completely unknown factor, namely sort of referendum politics into the European crisis, which is hugely destabilizing. So I think it's fair to say that this adds considerably to an already highly uncertain situation.
Yeah, I was thinking actually of Silvio Berlusconi in Italy. You could see him doing almost the same thing as Papandreou did, right? He's in political trouble at home. He needs austerity budgets.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that this is really the main fear from the French and the Germans, and particularly French President Nicolas Sarkozy, who basically thought that he sort of had more or less delivered last week the successful outcome of his G20 summit as a host. And now it turns out that he may actually end up showing up as the European host without a deal, which means that he runs the risk that this big thing also for his reelection campaign is going to be a huge failure.
Jacob Kierkegaard, he's a research fellow at the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Whether that European deal sticks or fails, our broadcast tomorrow is going to be a special collaboration with the BBC and its main business program, Business Daily, on how the Eurozone crisis is playing out all over the world. Back here, one hesitates to make too much of any given news item on any given day, but I draw this to your attention on this Tuesday. Bank of America has backed off those plans it announced a week or two ago to charge fees for debit cards. Chase and Wells Fargo 86 their fees while they were still in the testing stage last week. But Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports banks are eventually going to get you.
Fighting bank fees seems a little like playing whack-a-mole. You know the game where a mole pops up, you smash it down, and another mole pops up somewhere else? Sure, customers got a win today when they thumped down big banks' plans to charge for debit cards, but
I don't think the banks are just going to take this lying down.
Jim Sinegal is an analyst at Morningstar.
I think they're going to try to implement other fees, other areas, new ways of charging customers in order to maintain the same level of profitability they had previously.
He says fees will keep popping up, like those moles, as banks try to make up the billions in revenue they're expected to lose from laws that limit fees for debit card purchases and account overdrafts. Mitchell Peterson is the chair of the finance department at the Kellogg School of Management at Northwestern University.
In some sense, the checking accounts we've always perceived to be free in the last decade because we haven't formally paid fees for them. They're never free.
The service costs banks. They've got to pay for it somehow. And the big banks have to answer to a group of people other than account holders.
All these fee changes are, on one side I have customers, on the other side I have shareholders.
Peterson expects the next set of fees could pop up in the form of new costs for checks or maybe raising minimum deposit amounts. So you're going to want to keep your eyes trained on those bank statements. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
That part earlier where I said stock markets tanked, I meant it. We'll have the sad music and I'd wager the wah-wah trombones, although I never know in advance. We'll have it when we do the numbers. Two months from today, IBM is going to have a new CEO, and she's a she. Virginia Rometty takes over come the first of the year. She's been with IBM for 30 years, starting back when the number of women running a Fortune 500 company could be counted in the low single digits. Now, it's all the way up to 12. So commentator Christina Wong took the opportunity to write a letter to IBM's future CEO.
Dear Virginia, you go, sister! Media reports are saying you are ready for the challenge. Can I call you Jenny, since that's what the IBMers call you? Now, the presence of women among top-ranking CEOs of major corporations is a whopping 3%. As IBM's first woman CEO in 100 years, they're starting to call you Big Pink, a play on IBM's Big Blue motto. Somehow, IBM, with its change in leadership, has suddenly become all pastel. And, of course, collaborative, thoughtful, and caring. Aren't those just coded words for women in leadership positions? But you'll have to prove, as many women in the workplace do, that you know how to rumble with the big boys. But, Ginny, I actually want to encourage you to live up to the dreaded stereotypes that discreetly keep women from breaking that glass ceiling. Hear me out. First off, how about owning up to Paul Horn's former head of IBM Research description that people trust you? Instead of just playing into the social perception that women are more trustworthy, Ginny, you could actually be honest. You, Ginny, can lead the way in corporate honesty and accountability. What a revolutionary idea. And just to mix up this big pink persona, how about injecting your leadership style with what corporate bigwigs might dismiss as angry feminist stuff? Why not find a way to make sure that women are no longer making 77 cents to each dollar their male counterparts get for the same workload? Get in there and kick butt. Let's face it, I'm not the only one who thought IBM all but disappeared with those giant gray machines you used to sell in the 80s. You got quite a lot of work to do. Imagine if you led with the compassion, humanity, and equality that aren't just characteristics of a big pink CEO, but a model for your fellow CEOs and the corporations of the future. Now that would be a big success.
A letter from Christina Wong. She's a writer and performer here in Los Angeles. You can send us your letters about anything you hear on the broadcast. Go to marketplace.org, click on the link that says contact. I'm about to speak two of the most dreaded words in public broadcasting. Here you go. Pledge drive. No, it's not that time again, but there is a cable station launching today in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, where it's that time all the time. Yeah, you heard it right. A public television station that reruns nothing but pledge drives all the livelong day. Marketplace's Gregory Warner has the story, and it's not going to cost you a dime.
WQED, the public television station in Pittsburgh, launched its newest cable channel today with a rerun of Easy Recipes for Thrifty Cooking.
And here they are. They're genuine Pittsburgh recipes from Pittsburghers submitted together in one book, which we're making available right now for your membership pledge to WQED in the amount of $60. So I hope you'll go to your phone.
So call now or call later, because these phones are always
open. Not waste any time. Go to the phone and join us and get a copy of the brand new book.
Introducing Channel 13.4, the first cable channel to continuously stream public television pledge show reruns. Remember Doctor Who and the time loop?
Now that we're stuck here for eternity, at least
you won't be bored.
Wait, what, we're stuck?
In a time loop, a space loop.
I don't get it. I mean, I don't know why anybody would listen or watch.
Doug Eichten runs DEI, a nonprofit that works with public media fundraisers. He says other stations are shortening pledge drives, not making them 24/7 cable.
Unless what it is a very transactional, almost home shopping network type operation.
Home shopping network, that's kind of a public television slur. But WQED station president Deborah Acklin hopes this channel will bring in $2,000 a week in pledges. And that's a lot of coffee mugs and tote bags.
I think in public broadcasting, we're a little bit embarrassed about pledge, and we shouldn't be. We forget that audiences do tune into pledge, and there's some people who just plain love it.
Okay, love pledge. Apparently they're out there.
We call them the pledge fanatics.
Craig Reed is director of research at Track Media. He says at every public television focus group, there are always one or two people who can't get enough pledge shows. Celtic Dancing, Doo-Wop by the Marcells, Bring It On. Michael Soper is a former senior VP of development at PBS. He says a lot of pledge content is designed to trigger memories.
You can use nostalgia to make an emotional connection with people.
And then you ask them for money.
Well, you hopefully continue that emotional connection. You know, it goes from the music to the person who says, you know, I helped make it possible. I'm doing something for my community.
Which is a beautiful public broadcasting sentiment. But the whole idea of pledge is that you do your duty and then we go away.
Wow. And at the $250 level, we'll send you the DVD and
Michael,
this beautiful coffee table book.
We're not
and
pledging
Popeil, Pocket
now.
Fisherman. And there's more.
And there's always more. In Philadelphia, I'm Gregory Warner for Marketplace.
Coming up.
Today, Europe may seem to pose a threat to the American dream, but it may also provide a solution.
An Englishman in Los Angeles. But first, let's do the numbers. No, it's not the wah-wah trombones. Oh, man, I really thought it was going to be. The Dow Industrial slid 297 points today, nearly 2.5%, ended at 11,657. The NASDAQ erased 77 points, 2.9%, closed at 2606. The S&P 500 nosed down 35 points, 2.8%, finished at 1218. Shows what I know, right? U.S. bank stocks kept heading the wrong way. J.P. Morgan Chase and Goldman Sachs each withdrew more than 5%. Bank of America gave away 6.3%. Citigroup drew down 7.3% today. Stocks tied to the broader economy also felt the pinch. General Electric dimmed more than 4% today. Oil-filled contractor Baker Hughes drained away 7.3% after it missed third-quarter estimates. The price of the 10-year T-note kept on ticking up, which means the yield kept on ticking down to 1.99%. You're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by PBS, presenting The Fabric of the Cosmos, a new Nova series with physicist and author Brian Greene. Starts Wednesday at 9, 8 Central on PBS. By Reputation.com, monitoring, protecting, and improving reputations online while deleting personal data from the Internet. Reputation.com. And by Indiana University's Kelley School of Business, providing a personalized approach to career advancement. Learn more at kellei.iu.edu. Every day, be sure to wake up to the Marketplace Morning Report. It's 8 minutes of radio you can't afford to miss. You'll hear updates on all the latest developments in business and finance as they happen.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Wednesday. Fed Chairman Ben Bernanke is scheduled to give remarks on the economy. The status of global nuclear deployment is the topic at the American Nuclear Society's annual winter meeting continuing in Washington. And Howard Hughes' giant flying boat, the Spruce Goose, took its one and only flight on November 2, 1947. Flight time was about a minute. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. That's American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal, and it's time now for a little bit of Freakonomics Radio. It's that moment of your lives every couple of weeks when we talk to Stephen Dubner, the co-author of the books and the blog of the same name. It is the hidden side of what? Of, yes, everything. Dubner, how are you?
Hey, Kai, I'm great. Listen, I sent you a little something this week. You wanna open it up?
Okay. All right. Here we go. Oh, my God. It's heavy, first of all. Also,
it is heavy?
Oh, my God. Yes. Oh, Jesus, Dubner. Also in a bag. Oh, get out of here.
Yeah.
It's Heineken. It's a little mini keg of Heineken. It's one of
there
those.
You go.
Now, what I'm going to do? I'm going to put it in the Marketplace refrigerator.
Don't thank me too much, Kai. I'm actually just trying to save myself a little money because, as you know, Election Day is next week.
All right. Yeah, fine. But much as I like my beer, what does Election Day have to do with it?
Well, as it turns out, Election Day and beer inflation sometimes travel together. So here's Jeffrey Kubik, an economist at Syracuse University.
All right.
Basically, the year after an election, there tends to be beer tax increases. So if you are throwing your kegger during the year after an election, you're probably going to be paying more.
Right. See, Kai, the idea is that incumbent politicians may not want to hike beer taxes before an election,
right,
since the beer drinking constituency is pretty sizable. So
yep,
the taxes come later.
It's weird, but it kind of makes sense.
Oh, it gets weirder, Kai.
It always does, man. It always does with you.
That's my purpose
that's
here.
Right.
But, you know, most people, when they look at elections, they focus on the obvious winners and losers. That
yeah,
is the candidates themselves. We, however, this week went looking for some strange side effects of elections. And believe it or not, there's a growing body of academic research on this. So here, in order of appearance, are Ben Olken, Spiros Skouras, and Arka Ghosh.
In the period leading up to elections, we find greater evidence of deforestation.
In Greece, the area burnt in an election year is 2.5 times the size burnt on a non-election year.
Crime is lowest in an election year, and it rises right after an election for elections in India.
All right, so Dubna, that's a lot of stuff. We'll go the last one first, because that's the one that stuck. The crime drop in India. Incumbents, I imagine, want to show they're tough on crime, so they do more policing so crime goes down before an election.
Exactly right. And not just in India, but around the world here as well. Yep.
All right. So deforestation and wildfires, though, help me out.
Well, in Indonesia, where that clip is about, illegal logging is big business. The researchers who looked at this theorized that logging companies bribe incumbents during the season to look the other way. The wildfires in Greece, similar story. You can't legally develop forested land there unless it's been burned by a wildfire. So again, the theory goes that developers burn the land on purpose, knowing that the incumbents that they support just won't quite notice.
I know what this is. This is unintended consequences, right?
that's exactly right. You know, elections produce all kinds of consequences that are in no way an official plank on anyone's platform. And next week, with an off-year election, we might see the special interests who are always jockeying for influence have even more influence than usual. Here's Sarah Anzia from Stanford University.
When elections are held at weird times, like a city election held in the odd-numbered years, the people who really care about the election outcome are going to turn out to vote, meaning that each successfully mobilized voter goes much farther toward tipping the election outcome when turnout is low.
Right. So, Kai, Anzia found that teachers' unions, for instance, do incredibly well in places that hold school board elections in off years. In those districts, teachers get paid 3 to 4% more.
You're right. It's the disproportionate impact thing. Fewer people voting, your vote counts more, in theory.
That's exactly right. Now, we've argued before in Freakonomics that voting generally matters a lot less than people think in a presidential election, let's say. Mm-hmm. But next week, with off-year elections, you can have more influence than usual, and then you can, you know, go out and celebrate your influence with a cheap keg party,
guy. With your beer, that's right. All right, vote early, vote often. Freakonomics.com is the website. Stephen Dubner, we'll see you in a couple of weeks, man.
My pleasure. Thanks, Guy.
We've spent no small amount of time the past couple of weeks on the European debt crisis, what it means both here and over there. Tomorrow on the broadcast, we're going to partner for the first time with the BBC for a slightly different perspective, how Europe's problems are playing out all over the rest of the world. For now, though, a taste from longtime BBC contributor David Willis on how America is handling it.
If there was one thing that floored me when I first came to America, it wasn't the size of the restaurant portions, or that strange habit that you have of saying schedule when what you really mean is schedule, and aluminum when what you really mean is aluminium. No, it was the optimism. From the bank clerks to the cocktail waitresses, everyone seemed to have it in almost industrial quantities, to the point where the most basic of daily rituals could easily turn into something quite surreal. Take the simple greeting, "How are you?" Ask a stranger in America that question, and you could be knocked off your feet. "I'm great. How about you?" Ask the same question of someone in Britain, and you'll get something like this. "Well, not bad, I suppose. Mustn't grumble." Which is one reason why America was such a refreshing change. And no matter where I went in this vast and varied nation, that boisterous optimism was there to greet me, a testament to the power of the American dream. I often wonder when it started to go wrong. I first noticed it a couple of years ago, when everyone I met was either drowning in a sea of mortgage or credit card debt, or cursing the effects of the latest bout of European contagion on their pension plan. All that American optimism seemed to have evaporated. Suddenly, the future looked positively frightening. Witness my friend Billy, whose promising classical music career was cut short by a stroke. We meet every week at the same coffee shop, and in the time that I've known him, he's done virtually everything from movie extra work to telemarketing. Yet when it comes to a full-time job, he says they're as rare as a pig in flight.
I call them jobettes, which are basically under 40 jobs,
40 hours a week without health benefits, if one is willing to do two or three of those, that sort of situation is, I would say, readily available. However, I think the old-style full-time job that paid for the health insurance and lots of other benefits, is that I find very difficult to obtain.
But jobs are not the only thing that are hard to find these days. Another friend of mine, Brad, believes it's time the entire American middle class was listed as missing in action. A salesman for a security company, he's working twice as hard as he was a few years ago for half the pay.
The American dream, the way I used to see it, was that anybody that's willing to work hard could achieve the basic American dream, a small house with a white picket fence and maybe have a couple of kids. And it seems like nowadays you have to be of stellar intellect or have an enormous amount of ambition to just have the basic small little tiny square of house.
Today, Europe may seem to pose a threat to the American dream, but it may also provide a solution. We Europeans are used to a slightly more flexible lifestyle with a greater emphasis on leisure, and of course work-life balance, and that's something that a lot of Americans seem to be yearning for these days. But I'd steer clear of some of our other habits if I was you. The last thing I need is to greet someone on the street with a cheery, "How do you do?" only to hear them respond, "Well, not bad, I suppose. Mustn't grumble."
David Willis lives and mispronounces here in Los Angeles. Tomorrow on the show, a co-production with the BBC World Service and its top economic program, Business Daily, on the impact of Europe's problems anywhere that Europe does business.
Marketplace is supported by CenturyLink, a new kind of broadband company linking Americans coast to coast with consistently fast speeds and personal service. More at CenturyLink.com. By Reputation.com, protecting online privacy by removing your personal data from the internet and stopping unwanted email. Reputation.com. And by Putnam Investments, helping to solve tomorrow's retirement savings challenge. This is Putnam Today. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
These final notes today, a couple of MF Global tidbits we didn't quite have time for elsewhere. The first one's the biggie. Federal officials say the company that went under as its bets on European debt went bad used customer money to shore itself up as things got tight. Hundreds of millions of dollars in customer funds just aren't where they're supposed to be. Also, just because it's interesting, number 7 on the list of MF Global creditors is the business news channel CNBC. CNBC is apparently owed $850,000 for unpaid advertising, according to the website The Business Insider. Not, of course, that it did MF Global a whole lot of good, right? Okay, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM American Public Media this Tuesday. Today, the Dow slid 297 points, and I didn't get the wah-wah trombones. It's nearly 2.5%. The NASDAQ erased 77 points, 2.9%. The S&P 500 down 35 points, 2.8%. Thanks to Ethan Lindsay, Sonata Lee Narcisse, and Jolie Podokas on our Morning Report crew. The Marketplace Morning Report is produced by Rod Abid. I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll meet you back here along with BBC tomorrow. This is APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
"What is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?"
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.